Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more.
My name is Gilberto Valdez Sequeira, and I was born in Havana, the city of Havana, the 16th of August, 1928. And in that period, The Cuban society was divided in stages. Well, the middle class has the opportunity to travel very often to the United States, because in that period they didn't need visas for the first 90 years, I mean 3 months. And so the Cubans have a chance to fly and to travel to the United States for 3 months without any visa at all. So that means that the middle class of Cubans has this opportunity. So my mother, she was a millionaire. She was working making design of hats. So she has a place where she has five workers with her, and he has a client of people of the middle and high society. So it means that I've been in contact very often with people who have been traveling to the United States. And besides that, my mother, brother, they have eight more brothers, so the youngest brother my youngest uncle has a difference of only 9 years with me. So it means that he was a teenager when I was about 4 or 5 years old. So that means that he was a young Cuban who was all the time listening to music, jazz, and so forth. So I started listening to jazz from the radio, from the records, and so forth. That was the moment where I get interested with the American music. So besides that, when I started studying the high school and college, I started singing in the choir of the high school. And then I met a lot of friends there who always was interested in singing the American songs and so forth. So we start singing together. You may one with me making a second voice. There's another one came and make a third voice. So that means we started, as a matter of fact, we started singing there. So I made the first vocal quartet that we call it the Cuban Pipers. Because in that period, I was very fond with the American vocal singers like the Mills Brothers, the Pied Pipers, the Modern Air. So I was listening to all that kind of music. So I started making an arrangement. You know, it's very simple arrangement for the vocal quartet. And that's more or less the idea. Do you like to explain, Diana, if you want something else about it?
Can you talk about your trips to New York City and what you saw?
All right. Okay. In 1948, because my mother, she moves after the Second World War, she moved to New York because, you know, was a great demand of workers in that period. So in 1945, my mother flown to New York, and she stayed there almost 14 years. So my mother went there to work in a factory where they made hats and so forth. So I have had the opportunity to travel in 1948. I mean, when she was already settled, economically settled in the States. So I've flown in New York. So I've flown to New York in 1948. And of course, I have nothing to do except follow all the stars, the jazz musicians and singers. So I had the opportunity to go and see Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Harry James, and many, many others, musicians, you know, because I went every day. I spent all the afternoon and in Times Square, you know, and Broadway and so forth every day. So that was my first contact with the musicians, because also my stepfather was a musician. Oh. He used to play trombone. You know, he was a trombonist. So when I was also very young, about 10 years old, I started studying trombone. So when my mother and my stepfather they moved to New York, my stepfather also, as a musician, he was also a barber, and he opened a barbershop in New York, in the 110th Avenue, and the top of Central Park. And all the Cuban musicians that were there in New York in that moment, they used to go there and, you know, I cut their hair with my stepfather. His name was Humberto Gelabert. And, well, that's more or less the opportunity I have. During the period she was there, I spent a couple of times there. Almost every year while I was studying in high school.
Can you recall some of the clubs that you went to, music clubs?
No, not really clubs, because I was very young, you know. I was about 19 years old, so I went to clubs, but during the day, not really clubs, but bars. In that period, there's a lot of bars there in 54 Avenue, I think, or in Broadway, I don't remember exactly. They have many bars with live music, you know, a pianist and singer, but I don't remember the name, because all those places have disappeared exactly. You know?
That's true.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you saw Duke Ellington, Count Basie.
And one of the theaters I remember was the Apollo Theater. And I've been also in Radio City to be, you know, one of the greatest shows there, the music hall. All the theater, I don't remember the names, very many years ago.
Do you happen to recall any of the Cuban musicians that used to come to your stepfather's barbershop?
Well, Machito, Mario Bauza, some other conga players that I don't remember the name. And I remember that where my mother lives in New York was Madison Avenue, a few blocks for the bar where Jean Apostle was killed. About a couple of blocks from there. So I have a chance to visit the place, but I never saw Jean Apostle in New York, but I met him in Havana, because the place where my grandmother lives, it was about a few blocks of the place he used to rehearse all the composition, the congas for the carnival there in the neighborhood where I live. My grandmother lives in Havana.
Ah, what neighborhood was that?
Well, that's the Colón, very close to the two blocks from the Malecón, about three blocks from the Bravo Avenue. You know, more or less.
Gotcha.
That's Center Havana.
Did you spend any time with Chino Pozzo?
No, I met him, but I never went there. They don't let me go there.
You're too young?
I was too young, yeah. So I listened to music from outside, but anyway, I met Chino Pozzo much later as a musician, you know.
And did you ever encounter people like Benny Moray?
Yes, I met Benny Moray, yes, but later on when I was a professional musician already, you know, it was in 1949, something like that. I met it personally.
Okay, so your first trip to New York was 1948?
Yeah.
You were about 19?
And I've been there, and I've been there also in 1949, 1950, you know. Yeah.
And then you became a professional musician. Can you talk about how you became a drummer?
Well, yeah, so well, that's it's not a long story, but it's very interesting. You know, I make two quartets in my life. The first quartet was the Cuban Piper, as I said, when I was studying in the high school. Then I went to the university where I started studying dentistry, odontologist, you know. And then they started the process of the revolution in Havana, and they closed the university for 1 year. And that moment, we decided instead of being, you know, without doing nothing during 1 year without classes, and then we decided to reorganize a quartet. And I made the second quartet was called the Cavaliers. The Cavaliers happened to be one of the most outstanding groups in Havana at that moment. So I started working in Sanssouci. In Sanssouci, in that moment, we have the guest artists. Many great artists like Johnny Mathis, Tony Bennett, Ezra Kid, Sarah Vaughan, and that is the problem. When Sarah Vaughan came to Havana with a trio, I get very good friend of the drummer, Roy Haynes. Is his name, Roy Haynes. So one day, because with the quartet was singing, we have a piano player who accompanied the quartet there in Sanssouci. So every time we are engaged to play in some other places, I have to ask, what kind of instrument do you have? And they say, well, I have this trumpet and saxophone, always have a flute and a violin. So I have to be changing this arrangement all the time. Hmm. So we decided to accompany ourselves like the Four Frenchmen did. You know, do you remember the Four Frenchmen quartet?
Yes.
So the vocal quartet I made the arrangement very similar of that quartet, the Four Frenchmen. So then we decided to accompany ourselves like the Four Frenchmen did. So they start saying, well, I'm going to play this one says I'm going to play the bass. The other one says, well, I'm going to play the guitar. And the other says, well, I'm going to take the saxophone. So I say, well, I'm going to play the drums. So I went to Roy Haynes and says, listen, we have decided this and this and this, but I don't know nothing about drums. And then Roy Haynes, he says, well, I give you the first pair of sticks that I remember was the Ludwig stick of 8-7. With nylon tips. And then he said, well, tomorrow come to my hotel. He will stay in, I think, if I remember, the National Hotel. And he said, well, come, I'm going to give you a drummer friend of mine, give me his method of learning drums to promote it here. And you are the best person to give it to you. It was the Benson, Lou Benson, no, not the guitar player, Joy Benson, John Benson, the drummer.
Okay.
And there was that was the message he gave me. And he said, well, you have to take the stick like this. He said, so, and he showed me the first things. So I start studying by myself a little bit. That's the beginning when I start playing the drums.
Wow. So you were primarily self-taught from the method.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I just, because I read music, because I with my stepfather, I started learning trombone. So I was already in the third grade of trombone. So I played trombone in that period. But in the moment I was working with the quartet, I needed a drummer, not a trombone player.
Uh-huh. Hey,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Necessity. Hey, let's talk about the number of jazz musicians. For instance, I think it would surprise people that Roy Haynes was in Cuba.
Yes, of course. He the pianist, I think, was Hank. Hank was Hank Jones, I think.
Hank Jones, sure, that would make sense. Hank Jones.
Yeah. Well, one was the most famous trio that accompanied Sarah Vaughan and during the 50s, the 40s and the 50s.
Was it common for U.S. jazz musicians to come to Cuba? Was it a normal thing?
Yes, it was a very normal thing, especially because during that period, during the 50s, as far as all my friends, they would get together every week. They were jazz fans also, and we have old collection of records and so on and so forth. So we create a club. It was a Cuban jazz club where we get together instead of doing it, by ourselves, and we create a club where we put together all the people who are jazz lovers. And then we start producing concerts every week on Sunday those concerts, sometimes we invite people that from the state to come and play with us. Like, for instance, I remember Sue Sims, and I don't remember all the names right now. But every week, or not every week, but at least once a month, we invite some musician to come to Cuba and make a gig for this club, you know. It was there, and we have with the performance, we do it sometimes. We start doing it in Tropicana or every Sunday afternoon, and then we start doing it in the club very close to La Rampa that was called Havana 1900. And so in that club, we start making the concert with part of the musician of the Tropicana Orchestra, with Armando Romeo and Bebo Valdez. Barreto, Guillermo Barreto was the drummer, very good drummer. So we make jam session every week there, at that place. And we have the chance to invite those musicians to come. And then in Sanssouci, as I said, we have almost every month we have at least four guests coming from the States, as I said, Johnny Bennett, Sarah Vaughan, Eartha Kitt, and many others. So the management of Sanssouci was different of the manager of Tropicana. So they look at, they have realized that Sanssouci was making a competence with the Tropicana. So they decided to invite one of the star guests, and it was the first time Nat King Cole came to Tropicana in that period.
Oh.
And he came to Tropicana, so I have the chance to meet him too. Well, I went to Tropicana because I was working in Sanssouci. For me, it was very simple to enter in Tropicana and go in backstage. So I meet also there. And I can call and give a man and give a hook and so forth.
Can you tell us about the club Sanssouci? What was it like?
Well, the Tropicana nightclub is very famous around the world because it's the only one who still stands, Sanssouci was bigger, larger, beautiful, and famous than Tropicana. It was a really, really a beautiful, beautiful place. And when Tropicana started working, being as an open air, Sanssouci also was an open air nightclub, you know. But the difference is that the stage was divided in five levels. There's, you know, the central stage and three or four, like flying saucers, you know.
Oh.
Suspended on the air by the stream of water. It looks like being floating on the air, suspended
wow.
by water, you know.
Wow.
It was beautiful, beautiful place. And there, that was a place where the real high society of Cuba used to go. While in Tropicana was the middle high, you mean the less high society, you know. So the new high society, the one who used to go to Tropicana was a less expensive Tropicana, because Sans Souci was very, very expensive.
Ah.
And that was the place that I've been working to.
I see.
For a couple of years.
I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to talk about another thing, television in Cuba and your role in being on television when television was new in Cuba.
Yeah, exactly. You know, during the 50s, when they built in Vedados area, the Hotel Havana Libre, which was in that moment the Hilton Hotel, Havana Hilton Hotel, it was in 23rd Street and L in Vedado. Right in front of the building, the hotel, they start building a new center of radio. It was Radio Center, where is the Yara Theater, was in that moment was the Warner Bros. Theater movie. And in that building, they put one of the most outstanding radio station in Havana, CMQ. And was CMQ who started with the television in Havana. You know, and they start importing and making a studio there. When they make this building, they start creating television studios. And when I was in Sans Souci with the quartet, I was invited to start working on the television. So I've been in television every week because they have two star program at night. One was Casino de la Alegría, and the other one was Noches de Partagas, two different programs. One was in Wednesday, and the other one was in Thursday. So 1 week, I was invited to go to one in the Casino de la Alegría 1 week, and next week I go to the Jueves de Partagas. So every week, I used to be on television.
Hmm.
As far, yeah. So the people used to call us, you know, the how to call the TV icon, you know, because we were all the time in television. And besides, we make other programs like Café Pilon program and many other programs. We've been all the time in television in that period, during the 57, 58.
And TV was new around the world, but Cuba was one of the first countries to have TV.
Yeah, Cuba was one of the first countries in Latin America who has television, because there was an American, you know, United States company who was creating a new system of television, and they tried it and tested in putting a television channel in Havana, so that they were. They give the, you know, very good price, this the television system, to the radio and television company, Havana, which is CMQ. That's why.
Great. Hey, let's talk about El Zora, which is, you know, the big jazz
yeah.
club. Now, you had an interesting role in saving and preserving La Zora.
Yeah.
Tell what it was. How did it start, and then how was it almost closed, and how did it get saved? Yeah.
Well, the problem is that when the development of the size of the Vedado, we call it La Rampa, when they build the Havana Libre Hotel, I mean the Havana Hilton Hotel, right in front of the Creative Radio Center. Then they will build another big hotel in very not very far from there, and they have the airlines offices in at the end of the 23rd Avenue. I mean La Rampa, very close to the Malecón. That was a real commercial center, you know, and so that area became very popular. So they started there opening different clubs. And at the same time, you know, that in that period, during the 50s, they allowed to open casinos in Havana. So that means that all the little places where with music, they have the slot machine and everything, you know. So there was a great way to attract the people to play with the machine. They need live music. So that's why every place they have music. One of those places was exactly La Zorra y el Cuervo. But in that period, La Zorra y el Cuervo was not a jazz club as it is. He put, he make a contract to different kind of music, musician and music. Sometimes they have Cuban music, sometimes they have jazz, sometimes they have boleros, you know, different. So with the arrival of the revolution, you know, everything was closed down. Nothing was working. Everything was closed. So there was a company called Cari Show, and who the chef, the president of this company, it was in 1980, decided to reopen La Zorra y el Cuervo, as it was at the very beginning. And then he organized it to be a jazz club instead of a different kind of music, just jazz club. But they started arranging the place during at the end of the second half of the 80s. And at the 90s, they reopened it during the 90s. That is more or less. So, when they opened that, they started the musician who made the opening of that club was Bebo Valdez.
Oh, really?
It was Chucho Valdez. Sorry. Chucho Valdez.
Chucho.
No, Chucho. I said Bebo. Chucho Valdez. Was Chucho Valdez who opened that place. And also Borri Carcassés also there, where they are in the opening of the club.
Now, was there a time when La Zorra was going to close down and be changed?
Yes. You know, jazz is not a music that for everybody. You have to be a jazz lover to be in a jazz club. So what happened? Sometimes the tourism in Cuba was very low, very down. And the entrance to be to enter the Zorra y el Cuervo, you have to pay in CUC. So the population doesn't have the chance to expend $10 or $15 to enter the Zorra y el Cuervo. So the Cubans, they have very little opportunity to go to La Zorra y el Cuervo. So really, what La Zorra y el Cuervo needs as an audience was people with enough money to pay to enter. Mm-hmm. That means tourism. But the tourism was very low. And so the enterprise who was leading this says, well, we are losing money. So they decided to convert it in a pizzeria, you know, to sell pizza.
Pizza?
Pizza. And, you know, the musicians that we were working in that period, that like Hernando Pesnusa, Bellita, myself with Jazz Generation, and we get together and then we start discussing that cannot be. Is it possible we're going to be without any place to work because there are no many places in Havana for playing jazz. It was only La Zorra y el Cuervo y Jazz Café in that moment. Only two places to make real jazz. So we request for a meeting with the president of that company who lead all, you know, who was all the restaurants in Cuba or in Havana, they are under that direction. So the director, we request to have a meeting with the director of that company, and we explain him how does it work. You know, say, listen, this is that, and say, no, we have to close it down. So we invite him to, we say, well, come one night and you will see what we do. You know, I don't remember who was the musician who played at night. Well, he came at night with some of the people of the staff of the company. And they allowed, they said, okay, well, right, yeah, you're right. That's a very good thing, you know. Well, so they decided not to do it. So that's why, really, they appreciate us so much as Los Recuerdos, because we stand up and say that we were not, you know, we do not agree that they close it down. Not only because we have no work, because it's one of the most, you know, most beautiful places to make jazz, you know. And that's more or less the story of it.
Well, it's a great thing that you all got together and saved Elzora.
Yeah,
La Zora, it's very important. Hey, could you talk? Now, for a while, you lived in Europe in Paris, I believe.
Well, yeah, I stay as Sojour. We stayed 4 years in Paris. 2.5 years in Sweden, Stockholm, and 3 years in Italy.
Where did you perform in Paris?
Well, so many places I don't remember.
But you were
the most, places.
You were busy. You were busy.
Yeah, all the time. You know, making gigs and Opera Palace and the in many clubs, but the most important club I played in Paris was in that period the White Elephant, L'Elephant Blanc. It was one of the most important nightclubs in Paris in that moment. And I worked there for 1.5 years, every night.
Mm. And you had a quartet, or what was your group?
Well, it was my group. I have two groups there. One, a Latin group, we play with Cuban music, and we have a quartet that plays jazz. And in one, I play the timbales, and the other one, I play the drums.
So there was an audience for Latin music in Paris in that time.
Yes. That model. You remember Paris? All the jazz musicians, when they want to get famous, they go first to jazz, to Paris. Mm. You know, all of them. There in Paris, I met Donald Byrd. I met the Modern Jazz Quartet. I met, so many people I met there in Paris. I used to play my gigs, you know, jam station there where in the place in where Sidney Bechet used to play.
Ah.
In Paris, yeah.
Paris and France have always been very friendly to jazz.
Yeah.
But also, people may not know, but very friendly to Latin music, to Cuban music, way back, even in the 20s.
Yeah, exactly. What they do in Paris in that period, I don't know what they're doing now. Every club, every place has three kinds of music. They play jazz, American music and jazz, Latin music, which is Cuban music and Brazilian, etc. And they have tango music, Argentina music. Everybody has to do that. Because that was what the audience really requests. In that period, the tango was very famous in Paris. The Latin music was also very famous, and jazz also being very famous. So they have to play everything, you know, those three kind of music being in every single place in Paris in that moment.
And what period was this when you were there in Paris? What years?
I arrived there during the 60s, 1959. Yeah, I arrived in 59. Well, it was December 1959, so I stayed there December, then during the 60s, 61, 62, 63. Yeah.
Then you went to Sweden, and in Sweden you saw Bebo.
Well, no. I met Bebo in Italy.
Ah, in Italy, okay.
In Italy, yes. Because I was working with a trumpet player. He was a soloist, so he engaged my group. Well, I was working at the moment in L'Elephant Blanc, the White Elephant in Paris. And he came and make a contract for the group to accompany him in St. Moritz in Switzerland.
Ah, St. Moritz, yep.
St. Moritz. So from St. Moritz, he said he got a gig and a contract to work in Milano. So we took the train to go to Milano. But in Milano, the contract, you know, didn't realize, they didn't arrive yet. We stayed there for a couple of weeks and nothing happened. No tomorrow, no after tomorrow, and nothing happened, you know. Yeah. And so the pianist, it was a French pianist, he decided to go back to Paris. He said, yo, I don't get it here. I go back because I have work in Paris. And so two or three musicians of my group, they went back. So I organized a trio to survive in Italy. I was an Italian, I think it was Italian, I don't remember who, an Italian pianist and a bass player who came from Spain. He was the brother of Chapotín. Ah. His name was José Chapotín. He was a very good bass player who used to play in New York. And he was a Cuban musician, you know. Mm-hmm. And he used to play there in New York for many years, but he was in Europe. And he went from Spain to Italy, and I saw him because he was a friend of mine. He was a good friend of mine. So I say, well, Chapotín, you are here, so let's make a trio. And I engaged an Italian pianist, Chapotín in the bass, and I was in the drum. But in that moment, the trumpet player that was the guest star of my group said, well, I need a pianist, but there's a pianist, a Cuban pianist who's arriving from Spain. And so he invited me to go to the train station to meet him. And when the train stopped, the pianist player was Bebo Valdés.
Ah.
You know, that's it. I say, oh, Bebo, what are you doing here? Well, you know, how it is when old friends get together. And I say, well, listen, Bebo, the contract here in Italy has fell down. I don't know why he called you to come here and play. But I have a trio. And it would be very good if you would play together. So I say, I changed the pianist, and so I introduced Bebo Valdés playing with the trio. And with that, with having that trio, as far as the wife of Bebo Valdés, which she was a Sweden, so she was Swedish, and I say, well, why don't we get a contract to go to Sweden? I say, okay, all right. We start writing thing and say, we have a contract to go and work in Sweden. And then we took the train and we went to Sweden.
Ah. Very good.
That's why I never returned to France again, because I went to Sweden, and from Sweden I went back to Italy, and from Italy I returned to Havana.
I see. Now, of course, you knew Bebo from Cuba very well.
Yeah, of course. He was a pianist of Tropicana, and when we made the jam session, one of the best. The musician is also for Bebo Valdés. I know I met Chucho Valdés Chucho Valdés was about 11 years old.
Uh-huh.
I met Chucho Valdés, yeah. So we were very good friends. And
he was the pianist at the Tropicana.
Yeah, he used to play in Tropicana.
Now,
yeah.
Now, but he also had his own orchestra, didn't he, at some point in Cuba or no?
Yeah. He makes his own band for working on the radio and so forth. And the problem is that he created a band. I don't remember exactly the name of the band. But the problem, he created a new rhythm. He called it Batanga. And the rhythm of Batanga was very difficult because the percussion instrument, the main percussion instrument, was the bata. And not everybody know how to play the bata.
Oh,
bata drums.
Oh, really?
See?
Yeah.
Yeah, the bata drum have two skin, one on both sides, you know. It's different. You have to play with both hands, one hand, the left and the right. And it's not very simple. Not everybody know how to play the bata. But in that very moment, he created that band, started the success of Pérez Prado in Mexico. So it was a competition of the batanga with the mambo.
Uh-huh.
And the mambo had the great success. So the batanga disappeared there. But very wonderful band, incredible band, with an arrangement much, much better than the arrangements of Pérez Prado, but no success because nobody else can play the music because nobody can have a bata drums in his band, you know. Instead, the one of Pérez Prado, you have a conga, and everybody plays conga in Cuba, you know.
Yeah, everybody, literally.
Yeah, literally, yeah.
Everybody. Yeah, so now, I have to imagine that including a bata drummer was a very unique and unusual and original thing to do at that time. It was unique. It was original. It was nobody.
Yes, because as I said, the arrangement of Bebo was incredible. It sounds like Stan Kenton with Cuban rhythm, you know.
Ah, yeah. Wow.
It was a Stan Kenton band where the best solid musician in that period, trumpet, saxophone, the top musician in that moment in Havana that used to play jazz with us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were in the band. You know, the band was incredible. It sounds like Stan Kenton with a Latin rhythm.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Hey, speaking of great great bands, I really admire the music, the big band music. What do they call it? Banda? Big banda or whatever
big band. Yeah.
Big band of Benny Moray. I always thought it was very lively. It was very powerful. Did you ever get to hear his orchestra when it had all its members playing at the same time?
Yeah, sure, of course. As a matter of fact, one of his arrangers was a very good friend of mine, and we have studied together in the same high school. What was his name?
It'll come to you. I can barely remember.
Yeah.
I can barely remember half my names either. Believe me. Hey, speaking of the bata in a band, you were also the manager and the representative of Irakeri.
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that experience, if you would.
Well. But one day I was, get mad with the musician I have in the band. So I decided not to play for a little moment. So I was engaged to work in the recording enterprise in Havana. So I became the second person in recording there. I was the chief and I was a recording organizer, in the Grammy. So I was called because my experience with orchestras and my experience working and with musicians and so forth, they called me to be part of the commercial enterprise that where they were creating in Havana, with the commercial enterprise for artists. So I started working with Cubartista. And I was the representative of all the popular music in Havana. So when I started working in that enterprise, I get in contact with some lawyer here in New York that he put me also in contact with Sheldon Gold. Mr. Sheldon Gold was one of the artist management in New York in that moment. And she said, well, I don't know nothing about the Cuban artists and the Cuban music, but I would like to know about it. And I say, I invite him to come to Havana, to go to Havana. And then I prepare a concert, special concert for him in Tropicana. where I invited this Iraq Harris to play for him. And there was the beginning of the whole story, because he was the one who brought the Iraq Harris in New York.
Ah, and so, you went with them on tour in the United States, yes, and Europe?
Yes, yes. I did in New York. We've been in 21 or 23 states.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Hey, I'd like to talk about a story that you and your wife shared with me that was so fascinating. You were on a ship together that went to what island did it go to, or what country did it go to?
Well, yeah, you know, almost every year or every 4 years, a festival called Cari Festa. You know, Cari Festa was a festival that take all the artists from all the little islands around in the Caribbean islands. So this Cari Festa was taking place in Barbados. So I was the one who was at the front, in front of all the artists. They organized a ship to put all the artists there. It was about 300 artists going into Barbados. And one was the Iraqueres, was the Peyo Lafrocan, some group for ballet, contemporary dancers. Orfeo de Santiago was a choir. Well, about 300 musicians and artists going into that in that ship. I was there in front. And Ileana, he was in that commission as a translator, because there was also conference and everything. And then we met there in the ship. We've been together there. But the ship, it was in 1981. The moment of returning the ship from Barbados to Havana, the ship broke down in the middle of the Caribbean Sea. So we have to go to Curaçao, where they have to repair the ship, and we stay there in Curaçao 21 days. So in those 21 days, you know, we have time to make concert, dance, because there's nothing to do except that, you know. Yeah, because the ship was there trying to be repaired.
Yeah.
We have nothing to do except making music, invite all the people from Curaçao to come and see the show there. And yeah, there we get together up to now.
That's how you met your wife.
Yeah.
It must have been an amazing cultural experience for the people of Curaçao.
Yeah, it was really. It was. So far that every time we go down of the boat to go to the center, all the taxi drivers who pass right in front of the pier, they say, "Hey, come in, come in," and take us free. It was about 2 kilometers or 3 kilometers from the pier to the center of the island, the town, and the city, and they take us there free. They didn't pay because they were so far, because some of them, they came to see the show free also, you know?
Okay.
It was very, very, very interesting that period. Yeah, really.
Okay. Hey, I'd like to talk about one of your projects, Sax Ophelia, the group.
Oh, Sax Ophelia, yes, Sax Ophelia group. You know, my friend Emilio, he passes away because he passes away because he was very ill. But one day he came to see me. We met there in the house of one of my friends, Rafael Quiñones. And then he explained me that he was trying to make a quintet, well, saxophone quintet. All right, well, so he brought me to a rehearsal and so forth. And I say, okay, well, what you need is to play to have live music, because he was accompanying himself with background recording, you know. And I say, it's not good. That's very good for rehearsing, but to be, you know, to make a performance in front of an audience, is not good. It's not beautiful. You need at least a trio to accompany, a piano, a bass, and a drum. I never thought to be a drummer of the group, but I say, well, what you need is that. And he say, okay, you are the drummer, look for the pianist and the bass. Yeah, that's it. So I look for a pianist, I look for a bass player, and we start, you know, rehearsing with them and so forth and so forth. And everything was okay. Well, as far as I had the contact with all the, you know, the Sorry El Cuervo, with the Jazz Cafe and many other jazz places, I say, okay, we are ready. So I engaged, you know, to see those management there. And they contract the group to play there.
Great. And
that's the beginning with Sarto Filia.
Hey, speaking.
But he was a very, very good musician. And the arrangement he did really was very, very good. Really, I really enjoyed it. It's a pity that he passed away.
Mm. Hey, speaking of connections, when Dizzy Gillespie and Earl Father Hines and Stan Getz and Ray Mantillo and David Amram came to Cuba in 1977, I believe you were the host.
Yes, I did. Exactly. That was because the period when I invited Sheldon Gold to come to Havana, it happened that to get in contact with a television director from Canada, which I don't remember his name right now, and they decided to make a big, big show in Havana. And that was the beginning of the Cuban-American encounter in the Carmel Theater, where many of the, you know, the Fanny All-Star came, Chris Christopherson and Rita Coolidge, Stan Getz with the quartet, I don't know the name of the quartet, jazz quartet, where with the bass player, very famous, I forgot my name.
Yeah.
So well, they, many, many musicians came from to go down to Cuba and to perform there at the Carmel Theater with the big, big, big show.
And you helped organize that and make that happen.
Yes, because I was in charge of all the popular music in Cuartista. I was the one who organized all those things.
Wow.
You know. Well, just organized. I said, do this and do I need this, that, you know. I did nothing just to lead the people to do the things, you know.
Well, that was good.
And then
just last year, you made it possible for David Amram to return after 40 years and perform at the Jazz Festival.
But that was the first time I met him. Was in 1977 when he came for the first time with a group with Dizzy Gillespie and with a cruise. What's the name of the cruise?
It was some kind of cruise ship.
Daphne. And in that moment, I was really starting working with Cuartista. And the first job I did was take care of the group in preparing the performance at the Mella Theater. Do you remember Mella?
Oh, yeah, it's still there, and you can still go to the Mella.
Yeah. So they made the performance at the Mella Theater, and it was the first thing I did was to prepare that, you know, to get it in contact with those people. Not very deep, but, well, I make all those contact there. So in that moment, I met David Amram. And later, I came to New York with the Papines Quartet. Do you remember the
sure.
Papines Quartet? Yeah, they played there. So they visited New York in 1977. And I was the one who was, selected to go with them to New York. And then I met also David Amram, and we visited his place, and we've been together many times, having lunch together and talking a lot.
And then I had contacted you about David, and you made it possible for David to perform at the Havana Jazz Festival in 2018. Thanks to Bobby Carcassés made that possible.
Yes, exactly. Bobby Carcassés made it possible. Because Bobby and I, we are very good friends from many years. As a matter of fact, in 1959, we flown together to Europe to make the tour. And we've been working together for many years in Paris, in Sweden. About many years we've worked together in Europe.
Great. Well, thank you so much for this time. And I have one last question. Cuba is a small country. It's true. It's not Russia. It's not China. It's not the United States. It's a small country, and it has about 11 million people. And yet the musical culture and the musical power of Cuba is like a country 100 times its size. So can you tell me, based on your life in Cuba, what are the things that make Cuban musicians so special and so powerful creatively, because they certainly are, for such a small country to create so much amazing music?
Yeah, well, the problem is, like, you know, every society or civilization or country, whatever you like to call it, they have a specialized their own way of living. For instance, you can say, for instance, that in Hungary, they have the most greatest violinist, or Italy has the best opera singers. Cuba is due to make, you know, Latin music.
Okay.
So, yeah, making music. All the Cubans, they know how to make music, even if they don't play any instrument. They can say, sing, and anybody in Cuba can say, sing a guaguancó, or dance a rumba. You know, the Cubans, they are due, really, for music. But you have to realize first that when the jazz was starting in the States at the end of the 19th century, the development of music in Cuba wasn't the same time, reason that made possible the creation of the jazz in the States was the same reason of the creation of the Cuban music in the same period. That's what I used to say, that American jazz and Cuban jazz is the same. They started at the very, very beginning. But the Cubans, they have a gift for music. And besides, in Cuba, they really make some conservatories, very, very good conservatories the professor of the conservatory, not now, but at the very beginning, very good professor that really prepared the musician to be good musician. But now, after the revolution, you know, they create the ENA, the middle school of music, and they made the ISA, the superior school of music. Every year, while it comes graduated from those schools, they are the most, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but in English, but great musicians, you know, with a very profound preparation, technically, intellectually, and it's incredible. So every year, we have hundreds of musicians coming out from those schools, the ENA and ISA. But the problem is, well, all of them, they want to make their own groups, and that's why that's the reason why it's like the baseball. Everybody and boxers, they want to, you know, they like to compare the expertise with foreign people, and the musician is the same. So that when you go all around the world, you find Cuban musicians playing in every place.
Yes,
in Europe, in America, in South America, in Africa, whatever you go, you find a Cuban musician playing.
That's right.
That's it.
That's right. Yeah, I don't know if people understand how sophisticated the education for music is in Cuba. I mean, every music student learns all the classic music and then takes that skill and applies it to the Cuban music.
Yeah, exactly. Because as a matter of fact, in the conservatory, they don't allow the musicians to, when they are studying there, to play popular music. They have to attach only to the classical music. But the classical music is that gives you the expertise in each instrument. The Cuban music, you don't have to learn it. You have it in your soul. That's right. But that is they are very, very hard, very strong. Teaching music in Cuba. that's very soon.
That's great. Well, again, Gilberto, thank you so much for this this time and telling this remarkable history that you lived. You know, it's not just from a book; it's from your life.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, as you can realize, I was born in 1928. So it's a few days only. I arrived to the 90s.
That's right.
I'm 90 years old already.
Yeah. I didn't get to tell you. I'm a little late, but happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Great. And I hope to see you in Havana next time I'm there.
All right. I'm looking forward to it.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.